Have you ever listened to the pod and thought it would be awesome if Jen stopped being nerdy about movies for 60 seconds and talked about your business instead? Well, my friends, you're in luck. Watch with Jen is looking for sponsors. Do you own or run a theater, bookstore, film fest, website, school, physical media firm, pod, streaming channel, or small business that might like to advertise on Watch with Jen? Whether you're interested in sponsoring one episode or several, please reach out. You can get a hold of me at contact@filmintuition.com. Thanks so much. Hey, this is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. Well, this week, I am so glad to have two of my dearest friends. What's better than one Sean? Two Seans. So I've got Sean Burns, who is a great film critic for WBUR. Hilarious. You've heard him on the show. He also played Paul Schrader brilliantly. And then we also have my buddy, Sean Cosby, S.A. Cosby, the award-winning writer of Blacktop Wasteland, Razorblade Tears, All the Sinners Bleed. And he's one of those guys who's winning an award like every 2 minutes. I remember a few years ago, I said every 5 minutes. I think we've moved it to, like 2 minutes at this point. But we're all so proud of him. So guys, thank you so much for joining me.
Great to be here.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Of course. Well, when we were talking about doing this, I think we kicked around the ideas like before the end of last year, actually. I remember, Sean, you messaged me from the airport. This is going to be confusing. I'm going to be like, Sean, and which one? Messaged me from the airport with these ideas. And you
can call me White Sean.
White Sean. There you go. Black Sean. Yes.
I was going to say Sean B and Sean C, but, you know, it's 2020. Yeah. Whatever
you want to do. Yeah. I know the Sean's are spelled differently too, because I was just going to call this episode A Pair of Sean's, and now I'm like, but how, which spelling would I choose? That's confusing. But anyway, you did message me from an airport. You were like taking off for another book event with a few ideas, and you thought, great crime movies not called The Godfather. I think we wanted to originally partner you two up for last year, like Midnight Run Through. We weren't sure what we were doing, and so then we thought, let's get these guys together to talk crime movies. So we have a few that you guys selected, some a few of us like more than others, that kind of thing. So I think we're just gonna kind of free for all it, wing it. It's gonna be a hangout episode. Before I begin though, what have you been up to lately, guys?
And since I saw you two nights ago?
I know, right? I make them Zoom with me like, yeah, a couple times a week. I'm very clingy. No, just kidding. We had a group chat.
Well, I just got back from New York City. I was in Manhattan for a Thriller Fest, which is a big writing international thriller writers conference. Yeah. I think it was over 700 attendees, writers, agents, editors. It's a really cool event. I feel kind of facetious now saying it. I won an award. I won Best Hardcover Novel. It's the actually it's third time in 4 years I've won it.
So, I know.
It was fun. Everybody's so glad I don't have a book out this year. So
I know.
That's that great Nicholson story, right? When Richard Dreyfuss won Best Actor, yes, and he got in the elevator, and Jack's like, aren't you glad I didn't make a movie this year?
Yes.
And Dreyfuss said yes. Yeah, or he was, or did he say it? I can't remember.
Yeah, he's like, yes, I am. Thank you.
Yes. Well, congratulations, last year, man.
Oh, thank you. Last year at the event, I didn't have a book out, and everybody that won, it became a running joke. Like when they were thanking people, like, oh, I'd like to thank S.A. Cosby for not putting that book out this year. So, I do what I can. So
that's funny. Yeah. And I mean, our crew is super loyal. We won't like name names, but I will say Rob Belushi, if you lose an award, Rob Belushi will go to the mat for you. We have some text messages that were exchanged from our event in a different state. We won't name names, where Rob was ready to, you know, like sabotage cars and do whatever jokingly, like, you know, who won? So as soon as we found out Sean won this year, I like messaged the group, like, let's all call off Rob. You don't have to change your name and go to Tahiti or do anything.
I appreciate the somewhat criminal support.
I know. Well, I think sometimes too, people like can't take a joke. Like our good friend, Priscilla Page made a joke after she saw Furiosa. Like she was so revved up. She wanted to go steal a car. And someone like replied, like, you shouldn't put that on Twitter because it's illegal. Like Priscilla's really going to steal a car.
I bet she could though. I mean, easily.
You know, she's super handy. Yeah, she knows her vehicles. I'm always impressed.
Like, if I lock my keys in the car, I'm thinking about who I would ask.
Oh, Priscilla, for sure. Yes. Or Rob, he'll blow it up. But yeah, Rob,
I need to drive the car after.
Yeah. Four wheels and a seat. That's all that's left. Yes. Oh man. Well, this is the perfect setup basically for talking about crime and crime movies. The four movies we sort of just guessed or came up with originally are the films Menace to Society, The Funeral, that's the Abel Ferrara, Blow, the Ted Demme movie, and We Own the Night. And I'm sure we're going to touch on a million others. So I'm going to let you guys kick it off with whichever one you want to start with. Do you want to go chronologically with Menace, or do you have an idea, Sean?
Yeah, I'll talk about Menace just because Menace to Society became one of those movies in my young adulthood. It was sort of like a seminal movie. It was like a rite of passage. It's like watching Scarface. You know, you get yeah. This is the days of VHS. So this is before streaming or even DVDs. And so it was one of those movies that we passed around and you go see it at your friend's house. And you had to turn the sound down because you didn't want their parents to hear. And so it was sort of this movie that it, for me anyway, it took all the elements of the crime movies from the past that I love. Like I said before, Scarface and
Mean Streets,
all these
too.
Mean Streets yeah. And Goodfellas and the Casino, but it sort of reinterpreted them through a more a different prism, so to speak. I'm from the South. I'm not from South Central LA, but those actors, Tyrone Turner, Lorenz Tate, really sort of spoke to me, not just as an African American kid, but as a young kid. These weren't Italian mobsters. These weren't Irish gangsters. These yeah. weren't guys in Hell's Kitchen. They were just young kids who weren't that much older than me. It sort of the Hughes brothers who directed it, Alan and Albert Hughes, really, you could see all of the influences distilled through like one funnel, everything from, like I said, those old gangster movies right down to some Westerns and also sort of the black exploitation movies of the 70s. You yeah. can see hints of Superfly. You can see hints of 125th Street. You can see hints of...
Well, the guy even says, you know, who are you, fucking Ron O'Neill?
Yeah, exactly. And so it's a great film. I think it has aged pretty well. It's full of drama and pathos, but also humor. There's a wonderful scene where Tyrone Turner character robs a guy in a McDonald's drive-thru, and he's getting his money, and he's getting all his jewelry, and he wants a quarter pounder and cheese. And yep. So
he's a kid. Sense of, yep.
But there's also a sense of fatalism that yeah. sort of hangs over the movie. This idea that, you know, live fast and die young because tomorrow's not promised. I think, although Tyrone Turner is the nominal lead of the movie, Lorenz Tate as his friend Odo
yeah.
is just, he's walking ferocity. He's mm-hmm. he's rage personified, but also that sort of rage that the Shakespearean sound and fury. You know, where you don't know what you're angry at, you know, and it's almost the sort of an interpretation of Brando's The Wild Ones. You know, what are you rebelling against? What do you got? Mm-hmm. It's sort of that sort of chaoticness. Anyway, I love the film. I love the performances. It's the only film I've ever seen my brother cry at the end.
So,
and it was one of those things where we were sitting around and my brother's a big, tough guy. He's big like I am. He's tough. He's older than me. And we were sitting there, we were just transfixed with the ending. Because the ending, I don't want to give, well, you know, spoilers, been out 25 years. But the ending is so powerful. Yeah. And who you think is going to die doesn't die. And at the end of it, I heard this like sniffling in the corner. I'm thinking, because it was a mixed crowd, it was girls and guys there. So I'm thinking, you know, because I'm a 17-year-old chauvinist at the time, I'm thinking, oh, it's one of the girls crying. And I look. And it's my tough brother over there, like getting into his feelings. And so, again, it's just one of those movies that I think a lot of guys use and gals use as a passage. I rewatched it in advance of our discussion here, and it still holds up. I think it's, you know, there are obviously things that are dated and things that I, you know, are probably not, maybe not as socially acceptable today. But mm-hmm. the core story of sort of the idea of this endless circle of violence that you can't escape from, that you choose not to escape from, I should say, is still pretty resonant.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw it in the theater on opening night. Do you remember they used to open the Hood movies on Wednesdays?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah. Wow.
Because they figure if anything happened, the theater would be less crowded or something. And I'd be like, oh, cool, the movie's out on Wednesday. I don't have to, you know, waste a Friday night at the most. But, you know, and I'd obviously been a huge Boys in the Hood fan, and this was mm-hmm. so much more hardcore.
Yes.
It was like, oh, shit, the kid. Because, you know, the usual Hood movies were about, like, the good kid trying to get out, like Boys in the Hood mm-hmm. was. You know, and I was like, oh, no, these kids are bad. They're just, like, straight up murdering people.
Yep, exactly. And they don't feel anything. I remember, I'm glad you guys brought up Boys in the Hood, because that's a film, like, my mom worked at a library and, you know, she was paying attention to Siskel and Ebert. So anytime anything came out, she would rent it. So we watched like Malcolm X and Boys in the Hood as a family. And I remember being traumatized by the end of Boys in the Hood. And this one was kind of the way they were talking about it was so much more, it's graphic, it's exploitative. And so I think I watched it with a friend and it was, yeah, it's a totally different, both of the films are excellent. It was funny, our friend Jordan Harper posted like a Letterboxd review of Menace to Society after he rewatched it. And he said something like, watching it again as an adult, you realize like, it's an exploitation flick. And I don't mean that as an insult, like that's what they did with it, but it still really hits you. And I love what you were saying about choosing violence or whatever, the inescapability, because it's so sudden. The beginning of the movie, we're in this gas station and they're like, you know, they were just running in there to get something and then they get provoked and then it becomes someone stepped to them and are they going to answer it? And these things can happen in like 5 seconds without thinking, and just how scary that is, that your life can change that quickly. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think also for me, you know, a lot of my writing is concerned with tragic masculinity, toxic masculinity, how yeah. men don't deal with emotions. And so emotions get transferred into violence. There's a quote I have at the beginning of one of my books that all violence is a confession of pain. And I think when you look at that movie now, those guys are hurting. They're hurting so bad.
Yeah.
They don't know how to express it. They don't know how to share it. They don't know how to talk about it. Even when they're trying to be romantic, you know, there's a love interest in the movie.
Yes.
It's still couched in pain. Although when I was a kid, when we watched it, there's a scene in the movie where they're at a house party and they're playing cards, playing spades. And Tyron Turner's character, Kane, which I thought was interesting. I love name choices. When the writer, you know, Kane is the brother who killed Abel, you know?
Yes. And so,
name. And he sees his love interest. And there's another guy played by Clifton Powell, Clifton Powell is one of the great assholes in film. He plays such a good jerk. And he's and even when he's not being a jerk in the movie, you're waiting for him to be a jerk. But anyway, he's playing a jerk in this scene, and he's really hitting on on Jada Pinkett Smith's character.
Yeah, he's so grabbing her. It's creepy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so Tyron Turner, he turns to Lorenz Tate's character, O-Dog. He's like, are you strapped? And Lorenz, he says it with such glee. He's like, you know it. And he takes the gun from him, and he pistol whips the hell out of him. But it's interesting, that scene, because I remember watching it and growing up, I grew up behind a bar in the South, and I became very attuned to sort of the body language of violence, you know?
Yep.
And I remember watching that scene And I knew it before it happened. Like, he's gonna whoop his ass. And mm-hmm. Turner does such a good job of slowly letting that rage build in him. And you can see just the way he looks at what's going on. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't say stop. Nope. He doesn't say, what are you doing? He just grabs the pistol, takes the clip out, and goes and beat him up. And so it's interesting for me because, yes, it's violent. Yes, it's exploitive. But also, in that character's mind, he's defending Jada Pinkett Smith's character. He's being a man, whatever that means.
And we've seen how that goes for people.
Yeah.
Defending Jada.
Oh, we brought it to the now. I didn't even look that
together.
I don't
think Will has watched the movie.
Oh, man.
But no, it's such an interesting sort of examination of masculinity and tragic. And when I say tragic, because I make a distinction between tragic and toxic, you know, toxic masculinity is what men sometimes put out that hurts other people, where tragic masculinity is what we hold in that hurts us. And everything in that movie is about Turner's character, Kane, holding things in and letting it eat at him and letting it hurt him and making poor decisions. But also, it's sort of that like you were saying, Jen, the just quickness, how violence can just erupt over it. And also, the Hughes brothers do such a good job of something that happens earlier in the movie that mm-hmm. comes back at the end. And it's something that is sort of, you think, is inconsequential because there's been so much violence in the movie up to that point. You think, oh, well, this is just another example of them beating somebody up. This is another example of them acting out. And it has incredible consequences later on. I love that film. Yes, it's exploitive. Yes, it's, like I said, a little bit dated, but the core story is still, resonates with us. And again, I thought Lorenz Tate should have got an Oscar nomination. His performance is O-Dog because he facilitates from, he's 16 in the movie. You know, I'm sure he's older when he's performing, but he's playing a 16-year-old. So he facilitates from one extreme of just being silly and funny and goofy to just being terrifying. And the suddenness in which he becomes terrifying, it's such a good job. It's funny because I don't want to speak negatively of the man, but he hasn't had such a great career since. He's also been in one of my other favorite movies by the Hughes brothers, Dead Presidents, which mm-hmm. I love. I think Dead Presidents is a great sort of throwback
to
those, mm-hmm. Sidney Lumet crime movies. But he's really good actor. Like I said, I haven't seen him in anything recently, but those two performances stand out. So I love the film. I have it on DVD with the Hughes brothers commentary, with the great story about them originally casting Tupac, and altercation happens on Tupac gets recast. Like I said, I love the film, love the movie.
I remembered Lawrence Tate being in it a lot more than he actually was. That's what an impression he made, because I was watching it again just today for this, and I was like, well, where the hell is he? I remember this guy's dominating the movie.
He's only on screen for 20 minutes, maybe 25. He has he comes in and out, but the scenes he's in are, like I said again, he just has so much intensity, so much charisma. He really does. He has, you know, I guess the kids now call it swagger, and it's also a sort of dangerous charisma because he's not a good person. He really is. O-Dog is a bad guy, but he has that sort of weird gangster loyalty. He, you know, Kane is his non-blood brother. And he'll mm-hmm. do anything for him. And I mean anything. So, you know,
I think he blows the other guy off the screen. Check out Moses.
Yeah. Like I said, Tyron Turner is supposed to be the lead, but it's every time Lauren Tate steps into a scene, you can't take your eyes off him. You know, he's that magnetic. He's really intense. And I loved his performance. Clifton Powell as Chauncey is great. Like I said, he's a great jerk in the movie. And like I said, again, the movie has really good humor. There's a scene with Clifton Powell where a guy is hiring him to steal some cars, and he impresses upon this gentleman, don't ever come to my house before 11 o'clock. And like, it's just such a funny thing.
So specific,
Yeah, I hadn't seen it like since the 90s probably, and I'm not a fan of the Hughes brothers' later work. So it's always one of those like, do I dare watch it again? I have such fond memories of it. And is this not going to hold up? And like, I've never watched Amores Perros again because Iñárritu has turned out to be such a bozo that it's just like, it's just sitting on the shelf. Oh. Like, that was a great movie. I don't want to.
Oh my
and so
God.
I was relieved. I like this watching it again today. But
well, listening to you tell the story and analyze that scene where Tyron Turner thinks he's defending Jada Pinkett Smith, it reminded me of a story you tell. And if it's telling tales out of school, we'll cut it. But the story you tell about falling for Kim and defending her, do you want to share that one?
Or? Yeah. So my partner and I, we've been together for a while. And when we first started seeing each other, we went out to a nightclub. And so I grew up in an environment of very aggressive guys, very tough mm-hmm. dudes. My uncles and my cousins all worked like blue collar jobs and sawmills and fishermen. These were tough dudes. These were dudes that could knock you out with an open hand slap. And so anyway, I go to this bar and it's New Year's Eve and these guys were spraying people with champagne bottles and shaking up the bottle and spraying them. And so my partner and her friend had gotten their hair done and wearing nice dresses and these guys sprayed them and they did not want to be sprayed. They hadn't, you know, consented to that. And mm-hmm. I just got enraged and I went over to them. And I said probably the best threat that I've ever said. I hadn't put it in a book yet. Because I asked the dude, I said, are you going to apologize to my friend? And he said, hey, man, it's New Year's Eve, man. Lighten up. I said, well, here's the thing. You can either apologize or I can take that champagne bottle. I can shove it so far up your ass. You're going to shit glass plated turrets for a week. And we got into an altercation. And I was asked to leave. And we were on the sidewalk. And my partner comes up to me and she's like, hey, I love you. I do. I'm not going to deal with you if you keep doing this. And I was taken aback because I was like, well, I'm defending you. I'm your man. Mm-hmm. She's like, and I'm a woman. I'm a grown woman. If I want you to defend me, I'll tell mm-hmm. you. You don't have to do that. And, you know, I'm not going to stay with you doing that. I'm not going to be around you doing it. And it was really the beginning of me growing up, you know, of me, you know, stop being a knucklehead and understanding that, you know, you don't seek violence to resolve conflicts. You know, you don't seek anger. You don't use anger as a resolution technique. And, I had to unlearn a lot of stuff that I've been taught, you know, like a lot of toxic masculinity. And, you know, it's one of those things that it really inspired me to use that and sort of explore that in my work, in my writing. You know, and I think a lot of men have to come to that point, maybe not through violence, but just the inability to communicate sometimes. And, you know, we're not taught that, not allowed that. And so when you watch a movie like Men's of Society, for me now watching it again, like 20 some years later, and I hadn't seen it forever. You see how you can take the wrong path, so to speak.
Yeah.
And sort of this sort of perverted idea of masculinity can take you to just incredibly, infinitely dark places that you really don't want to go. And so, you know, I watched that movie. When I watched it at 17, to be honest, I kind of aspired to be like those guys. And now watching it at really, I realized.
At 29.
Yeah, at 29.
Well, there's that great scene in the jail with Glenn Plummer. And, you know, the showgirls guy. That's what I was thinking of. Mr. I Got Towels. and he has this speech where he's like, you know, teach my boy that the way we grew up is bullshit. And it's like a really powerful moment.
Yeah.
And it's the one time the Hughes brother, you know, that movie really is so flashy, and every shot is like a money shot. And then that one scene is just done in the shot reverse shot, very restrained, like we're going to let the material speak for itself here.
Yeah, just like the throwaway line on the phone when the girl calls and says she's pregnant and she says something like, you can take a life, but you can't be responsible for one. And again, I think, you know, you think so much has happened in this movie and people are getting shot left and right, but something you do will come back. Yeah. Again, some people trying to misguidedly get involved and
Mm-hmm. The last thing I'll say about it is that sort of sentiment runs through every gangster movie you ever see, that little things that you don't think are important, little things that you toss off because you live in a world that is suffused with violence and rage. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be these grand sweeping gestures that cause a problem. It can be something as little as not taking a girl's phone call or hanging up on a girl, or it can be like in Goodfellas. It can be, you know, somebody telling somebody to get the shine box, you know, and then things that should be
or Benny Blanco from the Bronx.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
And so, And so you see that in every gangster movie, the inability of people to process things. And so, like I said, violence is a confession of pain.
And that kind of leads into The Funeral, which I know is a film that really you love, especially. So Sean Burns, I'm going to let you take it away on that one.
Well, yeah, I mean, you want to talk about it, you know, violence. I mean, it's just rotting these guys from the inside. Yes. I mean, you're watching them. Mm-hmm. It's almost shot like a vampire movie. I know you'd made a vampire movie the same year with a lot of the same cast. But, you know, this was the Cagney Bogart Roaring 20s style vampire movie. But you're waiting the whole time for them to avenge. It's I don't know if people have seen it. It's kind of hard to find now. But it's Christopher Walken.
It's on YouTube. It's
not legally. They'll take it down if people watch it.
Who listens to this podcast? No, I'm just kidding. Says the host. Yeah.
Yeah, it's Christopher Walken, Chris Penn, and Vincent Gallo are three brothers. And Gallo's murdered, and you're waiting for Walken and Penn to kind of see then exact their revenge. And it's this very, you know, it's a short movie, but it's this long, dark night of the soul.
Yes.
And incredibly, you know, it's so rare that Walken gets to play a fully fleshed out person. He's such a special effect in so many movies.
Yeah.
Where you really watch him tear into a character. It's so great.
Mm-hmm.
And the poor women in the movie, like Annabella Sciorra, and like they're just stuck in these lives of like just watching men play out these predetermined codes of masculine vengeance that they know will do no good, but they got to do it anyways.
Yep. It's inevitable. I know. I think the standout for me is Chris Penn. I was a big fan of Chris Penn growing up. I told the story in a recent episode, like watching Footloose, like Kevin Bacon was cute. I had a crush on Chris Penn.
Because he steals the movie. He's incredible. Does. Willard.
I love Chris Penn. All these different movies, you know, was that the gun off my father, you know, the line in Reservoir Dogs where he's like, you know,
stop pointing the gun at my dad.
My daddy. Yeah, exactly. I love it. Yeah, Chris Penn is amazing. What a loss. We're going to talk about another loss with Ted Demme later. But yes, he really steals The Funeral for sure. He gets to sing too. I mean, he's terrifying in moments, but he also sings and you're like, shit. Yeah.
I felt bad because I laughed at that scene. Because it's like, oh, wow, this big Italian white dude is singing Down Home Blues. All right. But it's great. Like he's such a manic presence on screen, you know? And I thought Vincent Gallo's performance was done well also, like, because Johnny is, you know, these guys are all terrible people.
Yes.
But their shades are terrible. The degrees are terrible. And Johnny is, you know, trying to be less terrible, kind of. And I thought it was interesting when they finally found.
Becoming a communist.
Worrying about the working man, and such a good cast. But I thought, you know, there's a scene in the movie where they find out who did it, and the person who did it claims that Johnny raped his girlfriend, and then later on he confesses that's not what happened. He you know, again, back to masculinity. He got beat up in front of his girl. And then he has to exact revenge to maintain his manhood. Like Sean was saying, these sort of archaic, outdated, you know, codes of honor that are dishonorable. And I thought Vincent Gallo did an incredible job. But going back to Walken, I loved seeing him restrained. You know, he's like, as Sean said, he's not a special effect in this movie. He's not, you know, this sort of maniacal evil that he plays in a lot of movies. He really is a thinker. He's cold and calculated, but he's also tortured. He's tortured by the memories of his father, sort of what we call now generational curses that have ensnared this family. And, you know, Chris Penn, like I said, is manic. I hadn't seen it in a while, so I kind of forgot the ending. And I was, it's such a stark, strong ending. It's such a, you know, Abel Ferrara makes a lot of interesting choices in his movies. I'm a huge fan of his work. I love The Addiction, one of my favorite movies. It's probably my top five vampire movie of all time. But
That was the choices best movie he makes. About going to NYU. Just I came out while I was there, and it was like seeing my doing my classrooms and stuff in the vampire movie. It was wild.
Yeah, kill the people who are judging your dissertation. But the end of the movie, it's interesting because Chris Penn character, you know, spoiler alert again, we've been out for 30 years, I think almost. But you know, he kills himself. He kills Ray. He shoots the casket. And I remember watching, I just watched it, and I was thinking, you know, the motivation behind that. Like, why is he doing that? And I think for me, it is sort of this hopelessness. It's this despair. It's, I have to end this cycle of violence. I can't let this go on. Our lives mean nothing. You know, territory and money, those are fine. But, you know, I've lost my brother behind what essentially is a fucking bar fight. And it sends him to such a deep spiral of despair that he can't go on. He has that great line at the end when Isabella Rossellini's character tells him to put the gun down. And he's like, and live without my brothers. And it's just so heartbreaking. Yes. His performance is so good.
He was such an interesting actor because he could be a big, you know, he's a big imposing guy, but he also could be so babyish.
Yes, very vulnerable.
There was something fearless about it. His voice would get really high and, and like this like tenderness, this sad little lost child would come through. You know, I was thinking of it at close range, that scene when he gets it and you're like, oh,
yes.
No.
Talking about him and Christopher Walken again, I was thinking about At Close Range actually at the beginning of this conversation when you were saying like he's not a special, he's kind of quieter. It's a different Walken performance in that movie, but I think it's one of his best performances. And so it was interesting to see them working together again. Yeah.
It's funny. They played father and son and then they played brothers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No.
And they look nothing alike.
No.
No, Chaz is such an interesting character. There's a scene where he's at a party at his bar and he's making out with a girl and he kind of has this moment of reflection where he realizes, wow, you're really young. You know, you should go home. And he's offering her money to go. And then she makes a counter offer to give me a little bit more money and I'll sleep with you. And then he's like, no, take the 20 because you're selling your soul. And it's such a quiet moment that, you know, it's such a moment that shows such range of the Chaz character, who he really is. He's the hothead.
It's horrifying. Yeah.
Yeah. Every gangster movie has the smart guy, the hothead, the funny guy. And The Funeral, all those characters are all those characters at the same time. And so I think that was such an interesting choice by Ferrara and St. John, his partner, his writing partner, to sort of encompass those tropish characters in every lead character. They are the smart guy, they are the funny guy, they are the hothead, all at the same time. And it's a, you know, it's a gangster movie, it's Greek tragedy, which I have an affinity for. So,
and David Patrick Kelly is the union organizer, which is just the wildest cameo. You're like, this movie has an incredible cast, and then in strolls Luther from 48 Hours.
And Benicio del Toro has
yes, yeah. It was good to see Benicio. Yeah.
So yes. It's an interesting movie. I think, you know, Ferrara, he gets has a rep, I think, earned to some degree as a crazy person. But in comparison to some of his other movies, The Funeral really is. I mean, I've used this word before, but it is very quiet, restrained. Like I said, like Sean Burns said, this dark night of the soul, this sort of existential night that seems to last forever, you know. And there are a couple scenes during the day, obviously, but most of the scenes are shot at night. Most of the scenes are shot in a way where they're just shadows on the edge of the scene, you know. And you could almost make the argument that those shadows are death that's haunting this family, haunting these men who have, you know, chosen this life of violence, and again have made the choice. There's a great flashback scene where Christopher Walken's character, Ray, as a kid, is forced to kill a man by his own father. And, you know, it's this sort of pivotal moment in his life. And it ties into what Chaz does later on, that they've got to stop it. They got to stop this violence. And again, another thing that I'm fascinated with as a writer is how violence stains you, both physically and emotionally. You know, violence You know, I'm the type of person, I hate movies and I hate books where somebody gets beat up or shot like in the first 20 minutes and then they never mention it again. You know, I'm a firm believer in both, you know, literature and in life, violence has consequences and it stays with you. And the funeral is all about the way violence stains you, the way violence becomes a scar on your body and your soul. So,
yeah,
so it's that moment. Like it's,
I was just going to say, it kind of felt a little like a play in places, like Profane, Eugene O'Neill, or a little like Arthur Miller. Like you see them kind of grappling with the ghosts of the past and their, you know, their relationships. And I was just thinking, like, you could see this play out on the stage. Like this could be a Broadway play for sure. Anyway, sorry, Sean.
No, that's the line that always stuck with me from, you know, 30 years ago. I remember seeing it for the first time when Walken talks about how, you know, if I kill you, I will be sentenced to hell. And, you know, the trick is learning to live with it.
It's just
accepting your fate.
Yeah, it definitely feels like you made a good point, Jen, that sort of like the Iceman cometh
with
guns and with Tommy guns. That's what it feels like.
Yeah. Or you were saying a Greek tragedy, and it kind of reminds me of another one made around this period, which was The Yards, made by the same filmmaker of We Own the Night that we're going to talk about. But next film is Blow, made by another person we lost too soon, Ted Demme. And I know, Sean Cosby, this is a movie that you love particularly, so I'll let you take it away on this one.
I love Blow. I love Ted Demme's direction of it. It is, and now in contrast to The Funeral, Blow is this beautiful bubblegum technicolor cinematography palette. Everything is bright, shiny, you know, California and Florida and Bogota, Colombia. Johnny Depp is so funny because he's gorgeous in this movie. At one point, Johnny Depp is almost prettier than Penelope Cruz in this movie. It's like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, when so she kind of is going through it, it's like, wow, yeah.
Yeah, and he's such like, he grows his hair out blonde and long and, you know, he's got the Farrah Fawcett waves. But I think Blow is such an incredible, so Blow is the story of it's based on a true story of a guy who was basically the main cocaine importer. From the 60s on through the 80s. He's the guy who made a connection with Pablo Escobar. He's the one who made connections with the Medellin cartel. And he really is the person who brought cocaine to the masses, sort of. He's the
another Henry gift Ford from Massachusetts.
Candy. Yeah, the kid from Massachusetts becomes the Henry Ford of nose candy. But Depp's performance, it's such a powerhouse. I mean, he just, you know, he starts out as this, like Sean said, this bright-eyed kid from Massachusetts who just gets in business to make some money. And by the end of it, by the end of the movie, the toll, everything is taken on him. You know, and of course he uses a little bit of makeup at the end, but the toll everything is taken on him is just, it's horrific. It's just, it's a movie of, you know, made in the 90s, but it's about the age of excess, this me generation of the 70s, sort of this embracing of every hedonistic desire that you want, and you can get it all by carrying a suitcase full of cocaine. You know, he's great in it. The late Paul Rubens is wonderful in it. I mentioned Penelope Cruz. Everyone is great in this movie. Ted Demme, like I said, the late great Ted Demme, shot it in a way that is both hallucinatory but also very grounded in reality at the same time. Cinematography, like I said again, is lush. It's beautiful. It is incredibly evocative of its time. And you know, Depp is the lead character, and he's the best performance in the movie. You can't take your eyes off him. He is, at times, you know, he's treasonous and traitorous, but also loving and loyal. He's funny. He's smart. He's manic. To me, and I just thought of it because I just recently watched it, it's on par with Leonardo DiCaprio's performance in The Wolf of Wall Street, where it is a character who has done everything. He's indulged every base impulse and survives. You know, he lives. Yeah, he ends up in prison, but a lot of his friends die. A lot of his friends are killed or murdered, overdose. And he becomes the witness. He has to bear the weight of that sort of excess. And he does. And I, like I said, I love that film.
The cinematography by Ellen Kuras is amazing. She's such a good cinematographer. She shot Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. She shot a bunch of Spike Lee movies, including like Summer of Sam and Bamboozled. She also shot stuff for Rebecca Miller, Sam Mendes, Alan Rickman's film, A Little Chaos. Yes. And so it is a gorgeous film. It's kind of like you can't compare it, or you can't not compare it to some of the movies that were made in this era, like Goodfellas, you know, the wall-to-wall music, Boogie Nights. I know he was friends with Paul Thomas Anderson because Paul Thomas Anderson dedicated Punch Drunk Love to Ted Demme after Demme's death. So you see some of it's hard to separate. I also love the idea that we have Ray Liotta, who was in his uncle's film Something Wild, you know, just masterful performance. And here he's being supportive. He's a different role. Rachel Griffiths, I thought, was really good. I love seeing Frank of Attente too, because it's like night and day from Run Lola Run, when she's like, you know, got the screaming red hair and she's screaming the whole time. And here she's just like sunlight, and you really feel the weight of her absence when her character passes away heartbreakingly. But yeah, Rachel Griffiths, great. And I love how, again, we're talking about cyclical nature. He grew up in a household with the same parent dynamic that he winds up manifesting in his own relationship with Penelope Cruz, which is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't like the movie at all, but the level I do think it works on is as a horror movie about turning into your parents. That's the angle I really like. But I don't think
the soundtrack is great.
There's all these songs from other movies. Like, I mean, it opens with "Can't You Hear Me Knocking?" I'm like, oh, that's Casino. Sorry.
No, Black Betty, though, the way they use
Black Betty's Betty good. That's,
was brilliant. That's
a novel one. But no, yeah. I was such a huge Ted Demme fan. I remember being like so jacked for this movie. I was like, Ted Demme was like my guy. Going back to, I remember going to see The Ref.
It was the
first time Kurt Cobain committed suicide. Remember, it was reported that he'd taken an overdose in that hotel room, and so it was all over the news that Kurt Cobain was dead. And I was like, I'm so depressed. I'll go to the movies, and I saw The Ref, and was like, you know, it cheered me up, and because it's so goddamn funny. And then I came out of the movie, and Kurt Cobain was alive again, which, you know, lasted.
And you're like, this is my lucky movie. Yeah.
Yeah, and then Beautiful Girls. I saw really early, it was one of those test screenings. They would stop you on the street in New York, and we lived across the street from this movie theater.
It was shot in Minnesota.
They would pull you in and be like, do you want to see this new movie? And they wouldn't tell you the name or anything.
Yeah.
And it was, so we saw Beautiful Girls, and
About
40 minutes in is the part where they're all sitting around like in their Celtics jerseys in the bar, and they're like, asshole, dickhead, fuck you. And then the film broke and they had to stop for a minute. And my friend turned to me, he's like, you didn't tell me one of your scripts got produced. Because I love them. Those were my people. Like, I know Scott Rosenberg grew up like half an hour from me.
Oh, my God. My dad and brother would love you. That's like, they watch that movie multiple times a year. They will quote it at the drop of a hat, like special occasions. I think when my dad's stepdaughter got married, he quoted Beautiful Girls, I guess. They've made their significant others watch this movie repeatedly. I loved the movie, but we watched it so much in our house. I actually remember reviewing it for my high school paper. So we were definite Beautiful Girls people. And of course, Ted Demme, I mean, the legacy, also Yo MTV Raps and different things he did. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I was so jacked for Blow, and I was...
And let down by it, though.
Yeah, and I watched it again the other night, and it just, none of the crime stuff, I don't think, like, Escobar is scary enough. I don't think there's...
I will agree with you there. I thought he was a little too charismatic and warm, and you're like, really? Yeah.
Well, and there's no, I don't think it gets, I mean, you're talking about... All the horrors of it. Yeah. And it's nowhere near horrifying enough. I think that movie, it was where I was, because I was reading Glenn Kenny's Scarface book.
Okay.
Rewatching sure. Blow, and I was like, "Yes, the Scarface is scary." All of a sudden, there's a chainsaw.
Yes.
I will say I agree that the guy playing Pablo Escobar is not. He doesn't invoke the image of the guy who would, you know, feed people to tigers. Pablo Escobar fed people to tigers on his at his house. And so, you know, you don't get that image. I think the reason I kind of resonates with me a little bit because the George Young character is not a tough guy. He really isn't. He's just,
that's true. Yeah.
He's just this fast talking dude that can talk people into smuggling cocaine for him. And he can talk his way out of a lot of situations. And so he is sort of the antithesis of Tony Montana. He's not the drug boss. He's the drug courier, the drug smuggler. But ultimately, he also is sort of a survivor, like a rat is a survivor. I watched it again recently. I watched it again recently in anticipation of doing the podcast. And yeah, it hasn't aged great. There are things in it that don't work. The highlight for me is Depp's performance. I think he does a good job, but it does feel like it's sort of the surface level crime movie in so much as things happen to other people, but the main character, George, sort of insulates himself for that. It's almost like he knows these people are being murdered and killed and drugs are, you know, flooding the states. He doesn't want to think about that. He just wants to enjoy the party. He wants to buy a nice car. He wants to, you know, have a big birthday party for his daughter. And so in that way, it's a movie that is
missing
in the
crime those personal
world.
Stakes. Yeah.
Right. And I think I think that is intentional. I would, you know, God rest his soul, but I'd love to talk to Demi or whoever wrote the script and ask him, was that intentional? Did you want to do sort of this situation where he does live outside of the circle of influence of the things that he's doing? You know, he just exists to party and have fun and enjoy himself. I will say the ending sort of speeds to the ending. It's a little abrupt. Yeah. There is a scene that does not work for me, even though I like the movie. There's a scene where he's confronting his Mexican cartel connect, and he has Johnny Depp like put a gun to his head and like, you know, and it's just doesn't work because that's sort of the antithesis of who the character is up to that point. And he never does anything like that after it. And so it doesn't, to Sean's point,
it's a little showboaty, a little actorly. Yeah.
That was something you could tell they workshopped. It's like, yeah, I'm going to do this. It's going to make it really seem really
cool.
Tough. You know, it's sort of, I like this movie way more than I like, oh gosh, the one Black Mass. I didn't like his performance.
This movie, I think it likes George too much. Like, I know when you're making a movie, there's some degree of like coming with the customers and stuff, but like you compared him to like Wolf of Wall Street, but I'm like, well, Scorsese hates that guy.
Yeah.
What is this? Like, I'm supposed to feel bad for this guy? Like, he ruined countless lives.
Yes.
And he got off, you know, oh, yeah, he has to go to jail and his daughter doesn't talk to him anymore. Like, well, sorry.
Yeah, I think we did need some more characters and to see some other points of view. It was written by David McKenna and Nick Cassavetes from Bruce Porter's 93 book, Blow, How a Small Town Boy Made $100 million with the Medellin Cocaine Cartel and Lost It All. And yeah, I think that might be it. Like, he's an interesting character, but we might need some contrast, like, you know, totally different animal, totally different movie, but Traffic showing the different sides. Like, yeah, they bring it in the country, then this shit happens. I mean, Erica Christensen is on the street. Hello. Yeah. So we need that kind of stuff. Yeah.
You know, it's a great Ted Demme movie, Monument Ave. You want to talk about
crime?
Oh, God,
that's right. Yeah.
I love that. Is one of the Boston movies that gets it right. I mean, they're all 10 years too old for the parts. Like, you get Dennis Leary playing this, like, he's pushing 40 and he's like one of these 25-year-old knuckleheads at the bar. But in terms of like the small town car thief, like, it's so much more accurate than the town.
Oh, wow. I need to watch it again. I remember liking it, but that makes me curious because I love the town. But yeah.
Yeah, but the town's ridiculous. I mean, it takes place in an alternate universe where helicopters were never invented. You know, if you can just you can shoot up the whole North End, and as long as you get to the highway, you're fine. No one will follow
That is true. Now that I'm going to think about that. Yeah.
Well, I think The Town also is one of these movies that it's like, you know, I say all the time, if you want realism, watch documentaries, you know, and like, you know, The Town is an interesting film in so much as that it's more about the relationships between the guys, you know, Jeremy Renner is great.
Oh, my God.
That's our running joke. Yeah,
yeah,
that's
our running in our joke group chat.
Yeah. If somebody.
Well, that's another one that likes the main character too much. Like, you know, like.
Yeah, because it's the director, the actor. But yeah, in our group, if someone messes with people, there's a scene in the movie where Ben Affleck walks in and he's like, you know, I need a favor. We got to go hurt some people. You can't ask me what it is, what we're going to do. Like, we're going to go. And Renner replies, like, whose car are we going to take? And so we use the gif of whose car are we going to take?
Yeah. Well, I'll say this about liking the main character. I think that is sort of. That's a trope in American Western crime movies is that we have this idea that the criminal is, you know, is, you know, Robin Hood, that the criminal is, you know, and I think that's something that you see from the 30s crime movies and the Westerns, you know, the Legend of Jesse
James. The town was based on the book. It was like Prince of Thieves or something.
Chuck
was,
Hogan.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I think so.
Chuck Hogan. Yeah. And so I think it is that idea that, well, you know, he's a bad guy, but he's not really a bad guy. He's doing bad things, but he's a good guy at heart. You know, it is sort of that trope, but that's something that, you know, that's American films, like, you know, from, you know, White Heat all the way down to, you know, Goodfellas. I think Goodfellas is the one movie that's when you begin to see that change. You know, give that to Marty. You see that change where these are not good people, and I don't particularly like them. I'm going to show you their story. You know, and you know, and so I think you see that, and that sort of change happens in the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, and the change in that, you know, Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven. You know, William Money is not a good person, and Clint, you know, we're getting a far afield from the subject, but you know, Clint doesn't hate William Money, but he also realizes he's not a good guy. You know, nobody in that book in that movie is a good guy, except maybe Ned. You know, Morgan Freeman's character. And so, you know, I think that's
still, we've killed people for money before, you know.
Exactly. And so I think, you know, going back to The Town, I can buy the likability of the town characters a little more than George Young. So I do think that's a fault in the movie. I'm just enamored with Depp's performance in it. I think it's the best part of the movie. Paul Rubens is great too, as his buddy slash hairdresser. Which doesn't
wish he had more to do. It's like he's like he's up and ready for anything, and he kind of just fades out of the movie.
And
I remember when he made his entrance, the whole theater exploded. Like every time he would show up in a movie, people would go nuts. It was great.
Speaking about characters that you like too much, I'll just tell a funny anecdote. I've told this to you guys before, but for anybody listening, so I wrote a book called Blacktop Wasteland, and it's about a guy who's a getaway driver named Bug, and you know, I wrote it in a way where I like Bug, but he's a terrible person. You know, he's a sociopath. And I made choices in there to show him with his kids and his wife. And then I also made choices to show where he cuts a dude's hand off for the truck door. And so he just keeps slamming his hand in the door till it comes off. And so every year for Mother's Day, I will post a scene from one of my other favorite movies, 310 to Yuma. Mm-hmm. And it's the scene where Russell Crowe's character kills a deputy who's been talking trash about his mom for the whole movie. And just before he pushes him off the ledge, he says to him off a cliff, he whispers to him, you know, even bad men love their mamas. And he pushes him off the cliff. And I'll post that on social media, and then I'll make a comment. Oh, I think Bug would agree, you know, the character from Blacktop Wasteland. And every year, 15 or 20 people come in that comment, Bug's not a bad man. Why would you say that? And it's like, did you read the book?
I wrote it, dummy.
I wrote it. He's not a good dude. He kills like 9 people. You know, he puts his whole family in danger because he can't grow up and he likes driving fast cars. And so I think that's a testament to the sort of Western cowboy mystique mythos that our whole nation is kind of founded on. So, you know, when you say, you know, Sean Burns is right, movies like that like their characters too much. But even when we don't like our characters are, you know, people internalize it and mythologize them. So I think that's an interesting observation.
Tony Soprano problem, you know, that kept like,
yeah,
some people kept liking him more.
These movies all have great casts, and our next one does too. 2007's We Own the Night. Around the time that this came out, like a year or two later, I was running this film series over at Scottsdale Public Library, where I was like introducing the people on Sundays. It was mostly like little old ladies and stuff who would attend. It to character actors. I remember bringing in like You Can Count on Me, like, hey, this is Mark Ruffalo. I did 310 to Yuma to introduce them to Ben Foster. And one woman watched the scene where Russell Crowe is like eyeing a barmaid without breathing and started coughing and like had to walk into the lobby. And I checked on her, like, are you okay? And she's like, that man. So I loved this crowd so much. I showed Road to Perdition. They loved crime movies. And I remember wanting to show We Own the Night. And I was like all down, ready to do it. Then I watched it again and I had totally forgotten the beginning of the movie. And I'm like, you know what? That is gonna, like, you know, it's super sexy. Eva Mendes, Joaquin Phoenix, we're about ready to get it on. And it's, you know, really hot. But
I didn't even think of it. I'm wearing my Blondie shirt.
I know, right? Yeah, yeah. And so I have this weird track record of recommending films without like remembering super sexy moments. And like I recommended Drive My Car to so many people without even remembering the first 45 minutes of the movie. But yeah, so I substituted We Own the Night for whatever else they wanted instead. But I always loved this movie. I saw it at the theater, I think, twice. I went once by myself. I think I brought a friend back, James Gray, who did The Yards, Two Lovers, great filmmaker. You have Joaquin Phoenix. You have Robert Duvall, Mark Wahlberg, Eva Mendes. It's kind of a Sidney Lumet, Friedkin-y, French Connection-y sort of 70s throwback, gunmetal gray, great cinematography, killer soundtrack. There was like a third act thing where, again, spoilers, the bad guy becomes, or our main character who was, you know, involved in the drug trade, becomes an honorary cop or something. And I remember I called some law enforcement people in the family. I'm like, would that really fly? And they said, yes, actually, if it's a special circumstance, is the phrase they used, or special knowledge, if he had special knowledge of the case, he could temporarily, not the way it plays out in the movie, but he could theoretically do that, which I found interesting. So it did pass that test because it was losing people in the theater. They're like, really? Not to the level in the theater, but.
Lost me.
Yes. Killer, killer car chase. My goodness, you guys, like yeah. In the rain, amazing, very like Friedkin, eat your heart out. So take it away. What do you guys think of this one?
I will tell you, I ran a movie theater that was showing it, and I always made special care to make sure everything was right during the opening scene. I would always have to go in and check just to make sure.
I'll check it. Yeah. So around this time, Burns, you would have been like, Jen, are you sure you want to show that to the seniors of Scottsdale?
I'd be like, go show them. Yeah. Fire them up. Those old ladies need a thrill.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions about the way the police department works in this movie.
I know. And then it's like some people know some stuff about the case and others, you know, yeah, there's some logic issues.
Well, also the dumbest gangsters in the world, they don't know that they're like giving their whole operation to the chief of police's son.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
they
yeah.
Don't do, nobody does background checks in this film. They don't. Nobody knows yes. That the cop's brother is
I know, especially because it is the Russian mob in the 80s. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, that's a trope from the 30s, you know, that
yeah, yeah.
Oh, once one brother's a cop or one brother's
the
a gangster,
and
or
the
one,
gangster. Yeah.
Yeah. Or yeah, one brother's a priest, one dude's a gangster. So that's, yeah. You know, and he does use a different name. He uses
true,
his mother's,
his
maiden
mother's
name,
name
and stuff. But and it's set in 88. So, you know, nobody had Google. So, but
yeah, I'm really
the
kind of overlooking
from 81. It's weird.
Yeah. I have mixed feelings about this one. I love Joaquin Phoenix's performance. I think, you know, again, he's doing the most with the least in many ways.
Yeah.
I just some of the stuff about the police thing, which, you know, I guess you could be an honorary deputy, I suppose. Eva Mendez is, you know, I don't think she's ever been more sensual, more sexy, more present as a, I won't even say femme fatale. That's not the right phrase. She's just, you know, this walking personification of sensuality and also, and strength, you know.
Well, you feel bad for her because she's hooked up with this fun party guy and going to clubs every night. And then she's got to hide out with a bunch of loser cops for the rest of her life.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
I just, you know, it takes a really good director, in my opinion, to get a good performance out of Mark Wahlberg. John Gray's a good director. He's not a great director. And so, you know, in my opinion, I should say. And so Mark, just, I don't know. He seems outclassed in this. Every time he's on set, on scene, you know, you got Robert Duvall, Joaquin Phoenix, all these great actors, and it's Mark Wahlberg. And so he always takes me out when he shows up. The moment he gets shot in the face, I was like, oh, good, he's gone. He won't be back.
He gets shot in the face, Sean Cosby style. That's kind of a joke.
Yeah.
That Sean really likes people getting shot in the face. Yes. You know, I have
that's always
stick-
my
yeah.
That's my check.
Oh, the bullet went through his cheek and like he still got all his teeth and it's like
I don't know.
He's got this tiny little scar. It's like we saw him get shot in the face and it looks like a pimple.
I think he's pretty good in this. This is like in his wheelhouse. Though, you know, like Mark Wahlberg, this is what he can do. It isn't the Departed performance at all. But I think he is pretty good. But you don't really buy him as the brother of Joaquin Phoenix. And so it is kind of a putting them together. But as far as James Gray has used these people, you know, repeatedly, I know Eva Mendez is really proud of it. I think maybe it was either the first two kids or her one daughter had like the name of this character and the name of her Place Beyond the Pines character. So these were the two that meant a lot to her. Yeah.
I will say, like I said, Joaquin Phoenix is, you know, incredible in this. He's all like he hits all the right notes as this sort of, you know, sort of nervy, a party kid who he you know, you can see he's fighting against being a son of a cop, being a family of cops. You know, he doesn't want that light. He wants, you know, his partying in this is, it has so much desperation. You almost feel like they're not having fun. Like he's forcing himself to party. He's forced himself to, you know, indulge sort of dilettante lifestyle, because the opposite of that is to be a cop, is to be a part of that family that he doesn't feel he fits in. And, you know, I think he's good. And it, like when he's on screen, you can't take your eyes off him. Rob Duvall, as usual, you know, Rob Duvall could read the damn, you know, menu from a Chinese restaurant and I'd be captivated. The guy, you know, he's forgotten
also
more about
action. Shitty dad. He's a perfect shit.
Yeah, oh my God. Yeah. He is amazingly, amazing when he has to play a shitbag dad for sure.
Yeah. And I think, like you were saying, Jen, it does seem like it wants to be, you know, Q&A and it wants to be, you know, Serpico, and it wants to be Prince of the City. Really has a lot in common with Prince of the City. And it does have that wonderful cinematography. It's very gunmetal gray. I actually like this a little more than The Yards.
Me too.
I think for the soundtrack, like you said, is really good. That car chase is great.
The windshield wiper. Yes.
Yeah.
The sound design.
What do you think about Mark Wahlberg? One of my favorite movies by him is one of the late John Singleton's last movies, which is Four Brothers, which isn't a great
That's actually
film,
good.
But it's a lot
of
fun. That's a fun movie.
I enjoy it.
It's a very
it.
Fun movie. And
it's the Sons of Katie Elder. It's the old John Wayne movie.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful car chase and that in the snow at night.
Yeah.
Flying down these frozen highways and you know, Mark Wahlberg is great in that. So, you know, so is Tyrese and Andre 3000 is passable. And it's a very fun movie. Chiwetel Ejiofor is great as the villain. Oh, he's such a jerk. He's such an asshole in that movie. And I it's funny because that's one of my favorite Mark Wahlberg performances. I think because he's not acting, he's just being
Mark just Wahlberg. A dumbass. He's like shooting at the door open.
He's just Mark. Yeah.
He's just a tough dumbass that can take a punch. But getting back to We Own the Night, I think for me, it's a movie. I like a movie that aspires for greatness, even if it falls short, you know?
And that movie definitely, that's what I think. Yep.
It's definitely aspiring for greatness, you know?
It's trying. And
everybody's trying hard, you know? And, you know, and maybe for somebody else, it gets there. For me, it doesn't. But rewatching it, I did see, you know, the shot selection in it. It's great. Yeah. There's that great scene that was in the trailer of Eva Mendes walking down the hallway with the cigarette dangling from her lips. And the smoke sort of swirling around her head like, you know, like a dirty halo. And, you know, she's the street angel. And so it just has such evocative imagery. You know, the shot selection on the slow-mo scenes, some of it reminded me of some of the cinematography. One of my other favorite movies that's not The Godfather, Drive, which you and I talked about on our Neon Noir podcast. But again, the way the shot selection is used to invoke the feelings that the actors are supposed to convey. So it's the acting and sort of the way the movie wants you to feel. So I thought that was magnificent. I don't know the cinematographer, but they did a wonderful job on it, you know? And so, you know, it's a movie that in rewatching it again, I saw really great flashes of brilliance. And then some things that, you know, I think the script didn't do a good enough job of explaining how Bobby, Joaquin Phoenix character, becomes a cop. You know,
yeah,
I think,
it,
like you were saying, you
I had to make a couple calls.
So it really needs that.
Yeah.
I have an issue with like these Gray movies. I watched this in the Yards again recently because I didn't give them either good reviews when they came out. And I was trying to figure out, they look so much like movies I like, and they're full of people I like. And they're kind of trying to evoke the lament and freaking movies that I love. And I can't connect with them at all. And on one level, I noticed, especially with this one, from just the crime writing level, the construction of the mystery, it's just terrible. I feel like the Yards is missing like two or three betrayals and turnarounds. There's just sort of a basic premise that's set. And after 30 minutes in, you're just another hour.
It's a Greek tragedy. Yeah.
But you're just watching the same thing play out for an hour. Whereas this, nobody actually investigates everything. Everything's like through an informant. We've heard they're coming this way. And, oh, this guy just told us this. And it was like, well, you have like detectives.
His newer ones I have trouble with. Like, I did not enjoy Armageddon Time. Ad Astra, like, by 20 or 30 minutes in, I was ready to like leave, but I mean, I watched the whole thing. But so I know, like, poor Roxana Haddadi, when she listens to this, I might get a call and I'm sorry, Rox, I know you love it and I love your writing on it. But you know, I did like The Immigrant, talking about another one with Joaquin Phoenix, and that also has Jeremy Renner, who we talked about. Two Lovers, I think, is really good. Oh my god, there's
that's my favorite of this.
Amazing scene with Elias Koteas, where he's like the married lover of Gwyneth Paltrow, and Joaquin Phoenix's character is like hopelessly in love. And so he comes to their dinner, and Elias Koteas could not be less threatened by this guy. And I love the way he plays that, because Koteas is one of my favorite character actors. And so it's just cool. Like, he sees Joaquin Phoenix and he's like, yeah, you can hang out with this boy. Like, who gives a shit? Which I love.
I thought the ending of We Own the Night is good, though. I at the graduation, he sees Eva Mendes, he thinks it's her in the audience, and in the audience, and it's not, sorta, kinda, and it ties things together really well. To Sean's point, you know, because that's what I do, is write crime novels. I never felt like the script does a lot of stuff, like what I like to call fireworks. There's a lot of stuff.
Yes, that's a good point.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that should make you like be invested, like getting shot in the face. But to Sean's point, you know, see him later, it's like, oh, you know, it's bad acne is what it looks like. And really, like, I wish they had taken it there where, like, no, he gets shot in the face and his teeth are missing. He has to have his jaw reconstructed. One of the movies that I like, now I know this is not a part of our menu, but one of the movies I really like that nobody else does, and they do a good job of that, is the remake of Kiss of Death.
Oh my God, I enjoy the hell out of that movie. I don't like the taste of metal in my mouth.
Nicolas Cage and a really trying too hard David Caruso. And talk about getting somebody blown off the screen. David Caruso is doing this thing that I like. I really do. He's doing the quiet, tough guy, the quiet Irish gangster. But then here comes Nicolas Cage, and he has never been more Nicolas Cagey than he is in this movie.
Like, doesn't he bench press Hope Davis in that movie?
He's bench pressing strippers. He wears all white. He doesn't eat. He doesn't like metal. He lives his life by anagrams. Like,
balls, attitude, direction. Yeah. I mean, I've watched this movie way too many times, Sean.
Yeah.
Richard Price wrote it, dude. Yeah.
But the reason I was going to bring it up is there's a scene in the very beginning where Jimmy Kilmartin, David Caruso's character, is drawn into a heist, stealing cars and driving them over the state line by his cousin, played by Michael Rappaport. And they get stopped. You know, it's supposed to be an easy job. They get stopped by the police. Samuel Jackson plays one of the cops. And this old drunk guy, who's Jimmy Kilmartin's partner in the truck that they're driving, flips out and starts shooting everybody. And he shoots. And I love it. Caruso. And you almost think somebody would do this in real life. He almost reflexively puts his hand to try to stop the guy from shooting Samuel Jackson's character. The bullet goes through his hand into Sam Jackson's face. Mm-hmm. But the rest of the movie, horrifying. His eye weeps. And he can't stop it. And I love that. And I wish We Own the Night had taken it there with Mark Wahlberg's character. I like that movie. Yeah. A lot of people, it got panned when it came out. I think it was a part of the We Hate David Caruso for Leaving NYPD Blue sort of campaign.
Became, the whole story around the movie became much bigger than the movie.
Yeah. It's a fine, he also made Mad Dog and Glory, and I think he's great in that. Oh my God, he's one of the scene stealers in that movie. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I know it's not a part of our menu, but I love Kiss of Death. I love Michael Rappaport's death scene in that. And it's such a clip. Now, Rappaport back to Sean's
point. Good at like dying in movies. Yes,
it's to Sean's point. It is such a clever movie because the whole setup for that is what happens is Jimmy Kilmartin goes to jail and he tells Michael Rappaport, his cousin, "Hey, take care of my wife, man. You know, she's an alcoholic. She's in recovery. You know, take care of her." And he goes there, he gets her drunk, and he sleeps with her, or he insinuates he slept with her, and so. When Kilmartin's in jail and he gets approached by people to go undercover, he does this really subtle revenge where he names names for a crime that he and his cousin did, but he doesn't name his cousin. And it makes little Junior, Nicolas Cage's character, who's the crime boss, or the son of the crime boss, think that Michael Rappaport is the snitch.
Is there a better name than Little Junior?
Such a great name. Oh my gosh. Yes. I'm glad to hear that I'm not the only one who digs Kiss of Death. This has been really good to hear that you guys enjoy it. But I know so many of you listening love these guys and their taste and also are big crime movie fans. So other movies you want to recommend that maybe don't get discussed enough that are some of your favorites, guys?
Yeah, I'll just double back and push Monument Ave again.
Monument Avenue, yep.
Because that has, I think, one of the things I've never really seen in a movie when Leary and all the knucklehead guys are out getting hammered and then they stay up until like 4 o'clock in the morning doing blow and they're freeze framing the old VHS of Tequila Sunrise to see the side of Michelle Pfeiffer's left tit in the hot tub scene. And just a whole behavior pattern that's lost to the internet and porn. And, you know, it was such a nostalgic moment, really. Brought a tear to my eye.
The Gen X viewers.
Not that my own tape of Tequila Sunrise was worn out or stretched during the hot tub scene at all. Like, that was just these guys, but they're degenerates.
Yeah, just those men. Yes. I love Tequila Sunrise. It's so cheesy. It's so great. Raul Julia, I mean, obsessed with Mel Gibson's sex life. Everybody wins. It's pasta. There's sex. There's sex, there's fire on the water, there's rain inside a restaurant. It's just so coked out. I love that movie. Yeah.
So much saxophone. Like,
yes.
Whenever you see the words music by Dave Grusin, it's just bad news.
Oh, I actually, I know a lot of people hate his score for The Firm. I love it, but yeah.
Saxophone and synthesizers, man. That's when you know you're in a rarefied air in a crime movie. One of my recs that I'll give is another Abel Ferrara movie, but I love it. It's my brother's favorite movie, and it's one of mine. Is talking about Christopher Walken, King of New York.
Oh, yeah.
And David Caruso. Yeah, David Caruso's in that. One of Lawrence Fishburne's earlier roles. Christopher Walken is great. I love that it's, and I'm not going to wax too poetic about it, but I love that it's the anti-crime movie, in so much as it's just so weird. It's so freaking weird. Christopher Walken plays Frank White, which is, anybody who's a hip hop fan knows that's became one of Biggie's aliases in Biggie Smalls' aliases, Frank White, the Desperado. And he's this crime boss who's maybe Irish, maybe Polish. We're not sure, but he's the head of a gang of Harlem gangsters. It's just so weird. And it halfway through the movie, it stops being a gangster movie and becomes a mediation on life and death and middle age sort of hopes and dreams. I love it. It's so odd and strange. And just, you know, it was my first exposure to Abel Ferrara's movie. I saw it. And then I went and got Bad Lieutenant, which is a totally different kind of movie. I love King of New York. Lawrence Fishburne is... He's not on coke, but he seems like he is. There's this great scene that really, in hindsight, doesn't make any sense. But there's a scene where they're going to do a drug deal and they're going to rob these guys. And when they open they give the guys a briefcase, but they're supposed to have money in it. And it's full of women's products. And the guy's like, what is this for? He's like, oh, to soak up the blood from bullet holes. And they shoot him. And, you know.
The bullets, Pooja.
Yeah. And it's just such an odd, strange, but unique film. Again, it's sort of the distillation of, I think, what I love about Abel Ferrara and what drives me crazy about him. But it's a movie you can't take your eyes off. So,
well, I love it because it's like The Funeral. It's like steeped in these 30s Cagney cliches while completely inverting them. Because, you know, Walken wants to build the hospital for the kids in the poor neighborhood.
so we're gonna sell drugs for the kids.
Exactly, but it's all for the kids, for the neighborhood. And he's gonna kill every cop, like hitting a cop at a cop's funeral is the most ballsy assassination scene.
I don't know why you guys didn't come to see me. No, I love kids.
Well, great recommendations that tie in with what we were talking about, for sure. I want to thank you guys so much for doing this, for talking crime movies. We'll have to come up with another topic. I don't know what we're going to call you, the Parashans. We haven't quite figured out your cool podcasting moniker. But, a
couple of assholes.
So...
Basically, yeah. A couple of pretentious jerks and Jen. So...
Jen and a couple Shans. Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah. This was so much fun. Thank you for having me. It was great.
Thank you. Anytime. And thanks for chatting twice in 1 week. I mean, that's a lot of Jen. So.
Well, I was going to say, what are we talking about tomorrow?
Yeah. We'll figure it out. All right. Thank you, guys.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research, equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as a dollar per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more, by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.